I'm sure I've said more than once that one of my favorite things to do is get into a good book, and especially to get into a good book of fiction. Today we have with us the writer of this wonderful book of fiction, Of Sea and Cloud. This is John Keller. John Keller actually is an interesting individual you'll learn more about. He is his latest book, Of Sea and Cloud, was inspired by years of experience working in the secluded lobstering culture of rural Maine. Keller now lives year-round on a sailboat off the coast of Maine, but he typically returns to the Montana backcountry to guide each fall. Between the mountains and the sea, he's made a lifestyle out of working in and writing about traditional labors and the disappearing cultures that surround those labors. Thanks so much for taking time to come in off your sailboat.
Oh, thank you.
Now, you live in Addison.
Yes, not full-time now. Right now, I'm in Portland, in South Portland, actually, on my boat.
Okay. So wherever the boat takes you, you are?
Yeah, I spent the winter in Portland at DeMillo's Marina and then moved to South Portland this summer or this spring. So I'm here for a little while.
So you're here for a little while. Why Portland?
I wanted to be around more people for a little while. I've been living down east for 8 years and just kind of decided it was time to be around people and activity and bars and restaurants and so Portland seemed like a good place to try.
So you have an interesting background in that you've not only worked within the lobstering community, you work as a guide, you also have a master's in fine arts and creative writing. You've written books and articles. How do you combine those aspects of your life?
It's pretty difficult at times and easy at times. You know, at best, it's a good balance. You know, you're going to spend a lot of time in my head as it is. So working outside, like working on a lobster boat or digging clams or even guiding is a good way for me to get out of my head and to experience the world in a more physical sense instead of sitting by myself at a desk writing or reading or thinking about stories. So it's really almost a meditative thing for me to work outside. And clam digging especially is that way because you're alone and it's quiet and really beautiful. And so I get a lot of peace of mind from it. And also a lot of energy, I think, from the people I meet doing that. And that's where a lot of my stories come from.
As I was reading your book, you have an interesting way of writing dialogue.
Yeah.
And it actually, as I was reading it, I could almost hear, and I'm assuming this is what you're going for because you're trying to write to what you know. I could almost hear the guys that I know are doing lobstering, you know, where off the dock where I live in Yarmouth.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a very specific way that people speak. There's a very specific usage of words.
Yeah, oh yeah, for sure.
Did you spend a lot of time listening to the way people were talking in order to get to that place?
Yeah, it's funny. Actually, somebody, I did a reading at Longfellow's the other night, and somebody asked that question as well. And really, working on the lobster boat, I was a sternman, so I was just spending all my time was stuffing dead fish into bags, you know, bait bags that would go into the trap. And we didn't have a radio for music or anything on the boat, and so the captain played had the radio on, the two-way radio with the lobstermen all talking. And that would be on, you know, all day, every day, and just all the fishermen just going back and forth about whatever it is, you know, whatever's going on with lobstering, or if it's about food, you know, they talked a lot about food, or, you know, just gossiping and stuff. And so when I first started, I couldn't even understand what they were saying, so the guy I worked for would have to translate it literally because their accents and... But it wasn't just their accents, it was their speech patterns and the way the words would actually be ordered. So it was like the syntax was different than anything I'd ever experienced before. So it took me a long time to really start processing it and be able to, even, you know, after years of working there, I still had trouble sometimes understanding what some of them said. So just spending so many long hours on the boat with that being the only thing going into my ears is these guys talking just for, you know, 12 hours every day. It's just these guys talking over the radio. And I'd go home and write down a lot of lines. I took a lot of notes, and most of the notes I took were lines, just quotes from these guys that I could remember. And so I had, like, you know, notebooks of this stuff. And so slowly that just got into my head, I think. So that's what I really wanted to come out in the book, was this pattern of speech, not just the lingo, but the syntax, if that makes sense.
That does make sense. And it's interesting because you also have written, after each day aboard the boat, He took copious notes on the people and dialect that amazed him. These notes eventually evolved into a novel, but he was hesitant about writing that novel because he felt that to write about a world so new to him would be a form of trespass. To Keller, fiction writers have a serious responsibility, especially when writing about something that others view as sacred, and on the coast of Maine, lobster fishing is sacred. So I'm assuming actually somebody wrote this about you, talking to you.
Yeah, that's taken from several interviews I've done in the past. So
tell me about that. I think that is something that many people worry about when they're writing, is accurately representing an individual or a group of people or a culture.
Yeah, well, when I moved to Maine, I moved here to work on a boat, and I was kind of done with schools and universities and so forth, and just wanted a break from it, and I'd always wanted to work on a boat. So I moved here to do that, and I didn't have any intention of writing about it, but yeah, I just finished my MFA, and you know, my mind just works in stories, and so I'd write down these lines just because they're great, not because I was planning to use them. And so it took me quite a while. I had worked on the boat for a couple of years before I actually started writing. And I wrote just the first chapter of the book, which is now actually the second chapter of the book. And then I stopped because I didn't feel comfortable writing about it because I was so new there. And you know, all these fishermen down east were, you know, they're 8th, 9th, 10th generation fishermen. And I'd been there for 2 years, and I just didn't feel like just didn't feel right. I was still kind of a tourist in that world. But after, you know, more time went by, I just kind of slowly realized that none of these fishermen are writing books about this stuff because they're fishermen. You know, that's what they do. They're full-time. They're lobstermen. And, you know, I was a writer. And there weren't very many writers, if any, that I am aware of that had spent that much time working on a boat and spending winters working in a lobster pound and digging clams and stuff. And I talked with the lobsterman that I worked for, and I remember one day he had said, you know, you're not a lobsterman, you know, you're a writer, so write. And that winter I just sat down and took that chapter and just went with it, and so I wrote the whole book in like 5 weeks or 6 weeks that winter, just kind of spilled out. And then I spent the next like 5 years editing it, but so yeah, I still, even so, I still do feel a touch of, you know, that's not where I'm from, but I kind of mediated that by making the main characters first generation fishermen instead of 9th or 10th generation. And I hope it works. I wanted a book that any lobsterman could read and say that this is true to the place and to the industry. And every lobsterman I know that has read it has thought so. So,
give us a little background about the book itself, about the story. Describe it for the people who are listening.
Early on, the first chapter, there's a murder that takes place, and the rest of the book is kind of the fallout after that murder. And kind of the larger context is that it's this very isolated fishing village way down east that is being confronted with these huge global forces, you know, economic forces, as well as cultural and social. And so the price of lobsters has really crashed, and there's a fisheries guy from Boston who has a market in Japan, so he's looking to move into the harbor, this one small harbor, and raise the prices of lobster and kind of create a market there. And so between the murder and the price of lobsters and dropping, and then this new guy moving into town, it's kind of becomes this whirlwind of social and economic kind of upheaval in this really small village, I guess you'd call it, this one harbor. And so the local wharf, which is kind of the community center in that area, is changing hands, and the lobster pound that these guys run is changing hands, and so it's just a lot of change at one time. And the bigger context, like I said, being the global forces that these people aren't really even aware of, and that's really affecting them. So kind of simply put, like, the price of lobsters goes up in Japan, and it affects a guy on the coast of Maine who isn't even aware of that his lobsters are being sold in Japan. So it's just kind of these strange forces, I'd say.
And there's also a bit of a macabre element to this as to where the body goes.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't want to ruin anything for people who are going to read this, so it's a little, here's a spoiler alert for you, but why did you decide to go in that direction?
Well, a lot of that's because I wasn't sure what I was doing when I was writing the book. I wrote the book really fast, and I wasn't very good at thinking through plot lines. You know, my writing is, you know, it just kind of comes as it comes. I can't make notes ahead of time. And, you know, if I sit down and think about, okay, this is where I want the book to go tomorrow, then it's not going to work. It's not going to go that direction. So it was kind of unfolding each day as I wrote. And what I ended up with was this plot, this huge book with a lot of pretty central characters. I mean, there's not really one main character. And from there, I had to kind of carve out a plot. And so through all these revisions, there was the body ended up in different places and wasn't found, and then it was found, and I moved it around quite a lot, and then I just kind of arrived at how it is now with a lot of I don't know if it's mystery or not, but a lot of uncertainty, and I wanted that. I mean, the whole book has got a lot of uncertainty in it. And
yeah, it feels like it. There is that uncertainty even at the end. Even at the end, you know, there was a murder, but it doesn't feel like things ever completely get resolved with all of this.
Yeah, no, there's not. It's not a firm resolution, and that's one thing some readers have commented on, is that the end is definitely vague, but I think the whole book is vague in a way. And again, that was. For me, that is how I saw life down east, in a way, is like this. One of my friends down there who, you know, has lived there forever, after she read the book, she made the comment that the book was kind of like living there, and that if you're talking to some people, like say you walk up on a conversation, like you don't know what people are talking about unless they, you know ahead of time what they're talking about, because everything references something else, and it's just such an old place that it's really hard to understand what's going on, in a way. And I don't know if that makes sense, but it's so the book to me is that way, in that you really have to pay attention. Most of what's happening is under the surface, and everything has got a meaning that's under there, and so the reader has to really pay attention in order to pick those meanings up. And I think that was for me, that was kind of what echoed my experience there. And it also, I think, the voice in the book, it's hard to step out of that voice in order to explain what's going on. And I tried to several times to like step back and try to explain, because I knew there's a lot of diction in the book and a lot of things that happen just about commercial fishing and about boats and the ocean that people aren't going to know. But in order to explain those things, you're going to have to break from the voice of the book, and I just wasn't willing to do that. And so people have to tolerate the ambiguity, I think. And
is there a part that you like that you'd like to read to us?
I like actually the first couple pages, probably. I think the first few pages are the only time in the whole book where we see a lobsterman just doing his own thing without any of this upheaval going on around him yet. Ebb tide and fog and three slashes with wooden oars. No land left, only the fog, and the oars like bones creaked in their locks. A single gull rode the skiff's bow. The tidewater drained fast, and the lobster fisherman named Nicholas Graves leaned his shoulder and spun his skiff and rowed stern first together with the tide, and he and the gull both squinted into the fog. He told himself that his boat was moored here somewhere. He told himself that after a lifetime on the Atlantic, he could not be lost in this one small cove. He shipped the oars and ducked his head. He lit a cigarette. Water dripped from the oar blades. His sweatshirt hood was beaded with moisture, and his hands were cold and raw. Fog like frost spread atop his gray beard and condensed on his glasses and trickled from the lenses to the coin-sized patches of skin above his beard. From behind him, the gull watched. Nicholas turned to the bird and released a lungful of smoke and said, "You tell me." He smoked and allowed the ebb tide to draw him toward the mouth of the cove, and when he was finished smoking, he dropped the butt into the water. The gull circled and landed. Nicholas took a plastic bag of crackers from his sweatshirt pocket and removed one. He turned fully around on the bench seat to face the gull and held out the cracker in his cracked palm. The gull batted its wings and craned its neck and hopped on one foot. "Come on," Nicholas said. "You like them quite well." The bird flapped its wings in place and jumped into the air and hovered over top Nicholas for a split second. It landed again on the bow. Nicholas rested his knuckles on the wooden gunwale. He wiggled his fingers. The gull stepped hesitantly from the bow to the gunwale as if understanding this beckoning, and it walked the rail, and in a quick lunge it took the cracker and returned to the bow. Nicholas smiled to himself and turned in his seat and took up the oars. The gull disappeared into the fog, then reappeared like an apparition that hovered 6 feet above the surface of the sea. A few more slashes with the oars, and he saw that the gull was perched on the bow of the moored boat. Then the entire hull shape of the boat emerged like the body of a centaur beneath a gull head.
There is something that is very, I don't know, like the calmness of the sea, I guess, while you're reading this. Just the sense that there is action, but it's the kind of action that happens in a, I mean, I can just imagine exactly what you're describing.
Yeah, there's
just a little bit going on, but that you can sort of sense the fog, you can sense the quietness of it,
yeah.
You can sense the conversation the guy's having with the seagull. And there's a lot of that goes on in lobstering and in fishing. There's a lot of sort of quiet moments that happen.
Yeah, yes, definitely. And yeah, it's a lot of, especially, you know, in the down east stretch of the coast, yeah, there's a lot of fog and just, you know, it's all there is fog and water and rocks. And yeah, I think the voice of the book is really what I wanted to kind of give that feel. And the book is really written in a different voice than anything I've ever written before. And so, yeah, hopefully it echoes that, the place.
And now that you're living in the Portland area and you're still living on your sailboat.
Yep. Yeah.
What type of voice was coming through to you at this point? What types of dialogues and conversations? And
yeah, I'm not sure yet. I'm at somewhat of a standstill. I've been working on essays, mostly essays about down east area still. So about digging clams and working on a mussel dragger and lobster boat and stuff. So I'm still working with that same stuff. And I'll go back there at some point. I'm just kind of here for a while and enjoying myself and trying to be social after, you know, writing is a lonely thing, and when you live in a lonely place, they compound each other. So I just wanted to come up and get a breath of air, I guess.
And you live by yourself on the sailboat?
Yep.
So what's that like?
It's a great way for me to live in a city, because I can, you know, come into town and do the city thing and see people, but I can also walk down the dock and step onto my boat and be on the water and look out the window at the harbor, and it's quiet and it's beautiful, and I really need that. It's a good way for me to step out of everything. And I have a wood stove on my boat, so I can sit by the fire and be on the water, and it's something I need, I think, and I enjoy. And that's why I do all my writing. So I write on the boat, and it mediates the urban lifestyle for me.
And how does this contrast with the time that you spend in Montana?
Well, what I've been doing for the past few years is I go back in the fall, so clamming season has ended for me. I've stopped clamming in September, and I've gone back to Montana and guided elk hunting in September, October. And so it's worked out well seasonally, because the price of clams goes down in September, and you know, the big summer push is over. So it's nice to kind of finish that season up, and then I get on an airplane and go to Montana and go up in the mountains and see a lot of my old friends. I lived out there for 12 years, so a lot of my friends are still there, and it's a nice way to just kind of get out of Maine and get up in the mountains, because like I said earlier, I never leave the coast when I'm in Maine. You know, I stay south Route 1, and so yeah, my mountains and land-based activities usually center around Montana. And actually, until this year, Montana has also been like my big social time. So I go back and spend, you know, a week or two in Missoula. And coming from down east to Missoula, that was like going to a big city. And it was, you know, I could see all my friends and go out and be social for a couple of weeks, and then go back to down east and hole up at the end of this peninsula where I lived in this little cabin. But now I don't need that. But probably the only guy that ever goes to Montana for the urban life, but it's a good mix.
How did you decide that you wanted to be a writer? What was your background? Where are you from?
I grew up in New Hampshire, and it's just, I didn't really decide. You know, I think if I could decide, I'd decide on something else. But my sister's a writer as well. Her name's Abby Maxwell, and two of us talk a lot about that if either of us felt like we had a choice, we would do something else. You know, like looking at people with real jobs and 9-to-5 job, and it just seems so nice. And, you know, I love the freedom of my lifestyle, but it's a constant struggle, and writing is, you know, it's not an easy thing to do. And I meet a lot of people that want to be writers, and yeah, my attitude is if you can do something else, do it. But it's never really been a choice for me. It's what gets me out of bed in the morning, and it's, you know, every time I have a job, I save up enough money until I can take time off and write. And it's just how my brain works and what makes me feel good at the end of the day. So it's, yeah, it's not really a choice for me.
How has it been to do things like readings at Longfellow Books, or this interview here, or some of the stuff that's around the business of actually selling your book?
Yeah, I'm not very good at it. It's I'm getting more used to the readings and stuff, but you know, the first few, it was really hard to, you know, come out from, you know, being just alone at a desk for so many hours, and alone in, you know, a lot of ways where I was living. And I mean, I'll do what I can do, but yeah, that's
You're hoping it'll sell itself, I think, is what, maybe what you're saying.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. It's just, I'm not a self-promoter at all. It's just...
Well, somehow you got Anthony Doerr to write a little quote on the front of your book. He says, "It's a gorgeously written exploration of faith and loyalty, love and dishonesty. I will never forget these characters, these waters, the harrowing dramas that unfolded upon and beneath them." Which is pretty great. He's a National Book Award finalist, and I read his book also, All the Light We Cannot See. So somehow you got somebody to believe in this.
When I went to Boise State, he was a teacher at Boise State of mine, and he did a independent study with me when I actually wrote the first novel I ever wrote. And so he went through my first novel with me, and we just kind of maintained a correspondence ever since. And yeah, so when that book came out, he read it and really liked it. So it was really great.
How can people find out about Of Sea and Cloud and the other works that you've done, John?
Well, I have a website. It's johnkellerauthor.com. And Tyrus Books has a website as well. And yeah, the book is on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and hopefully at local bookstores as well.
Well, I'm very appreciative of the time that you took to listen to the people around you, to capture them, put them on the pages of this book. And I wish you all the best as you continue to do your writing, because you're right. You're correct. It's not an easy task, but it seems like it's something that brings you great joy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's what I'm doing.
We've been speaking with John Keller, who is the author of Sea and Cloud. And people who are interested, I think that this is most likely available in local bookstores, including Longfellow Books.
Yep, they have it.
Well, thank you, John. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thank you.